Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. Start getting your best night's sleep in these sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. Try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee. Plus, get 15% off your first order at bollandbranch.com. Code BUTTERY. Exclusions apply. See site for details.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
This Mother's Day, celebrate the extraordinary women in your life with a heartfelt gift from Blue Nile. Whether it's for your mom, a mother figure, or yourself as a mom, find that perfect piece to express your love and appreciation. Explore Blue Nile's exquisite pearls and mesmerizing gemstones that she's sure to love. Enjoy fast shipping options like guaranteed free shipping and returns. Make this Mother's Day unforgettable with a piece from Blue Nile. Right now, get up to 50% off at BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Welcome back to the podcast, everybody. This is episode 63. And we're dedicating this whole episode to the Goodwood Motor Circuit. And I'm going to pose the question right at the start. Is this the UK's best racetrack? How do you define best? Well, we'll come back to that. But anyway, Goodwood Motor Circuit, Andrew, that place has got a special place in your heart, hasn't it?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely, it's got a special place. Yes, I've been lucky enough to be racing there since it reopened in 1998. Before that, I think the first time I ever drove a car on a track was at Goodwood.
Yeah, that's quite cool.
Yeah. Yeah, so it's certainly the first time I ever fell off a track was at Goodwood, and on the same day. So yeah, I mean, Goodwood is it is as close to my heart as any circuit in the world, definitely. There's very little about the place I don't absolutely love, so I'm looking forward to this one.
And I mean, as we know, racing, sort of contemporary modern day racing, was going on there in the late 40s, 50s, and the first half of the 60s. So that's your era, isn't it? That's the era that you really love.
You make yourself so old.
No, well, no. I mean, I don't know. I suppose there's a romance for you about that whole era. And the point being, I suppose, is that if there's a topic that we can tackle on this podcast, for which you need to do very little or no preparation, it's Goodwood, isn't it? It's all up there.
We're about to find out, because I have done no preparation whatsoever.
So I just need to download you. We'll get back to Goodwood in a moment, but first we just need to do a couple of minutes on the Intercooler app. We're getting new subscribers every day, a good number of new subscribers every day. It's growing nicely, so thank you everybody for signing up. I think we've had some good stuff up there this week. We had Karen Chandock on Who Are the Best Racing Drivers. He was sort of posing the question, are rally drivers the best? Can you compare drivers from different categories? Some good insight from him there. Andrew English has been to the Great British Card Journey. It's a museum with a twist. It's the story of the British car industry told through the cars themselves, and you can actually go there and drive some of them.
Yeah, it's a load of sort of charmingly rubbish sort of Leyland stuff from the 70s and 80s. You know, it's the cars your dad drove, isn't it? I think that's the kind of the hook for it. And because these cars have all basically, you know, dissolved into rust or whatever, you just don't see them around anymore. I think they have a charm today they probably didn't have at the time. And you know, they've got a huge amount of space up there, and you can just go up there and nick the keys and go for a bimble about. I think it's a lovely idea.
It is a lovely idea. And more recently, you've published a story which is effectively, it's you driving to the end of your driveway in a Caterham.
Yes, it's 1,500 words on me deciding to go for a drive in my Caterham. It's all about the magic of driving for the sake of driving. and how it's not just about, you know, when you're up in the mountains giving it loads. It's about the anticipation. It's about the processes. It's about how you feel. The build up to it, just getting the thing started, getting it out your shed, all the little, you know, rituals that we probably all have if you're sad like me. And it's kind of part one of a story. The part two will be when I actually sort of talk about driving the car. But no, the whole thing is basically me not driving a car or preparing to drive a car. But it's, you know, I hope it's got a sort of certain resonance to other car loving people out there, but go take a look.
Yeah, that's right. It's a slightly curious premise, but it's a great story. Okay, well, go and download the app. Just go and check it out. You can start your free trial. We think you'll like it. It's easy to cancel if you don't. But just go and search the intercooler on whichever app store you use. I think you now only have to put in the space IN, and the search function will find the intercooler for you. It'll be right there. That's quite good, isn't it? Just go and download it. Okay, let's get back to Goodwood then. Why now? It's not as though there's an event there this weekend or next. Actually, it's just because recently, in the last few days, BAC have released some footage of a lap time that they recorded there with Ollie Webb driving of the Mono R, setting, it's an unofficial lap record, really, setting a 1:15 lap time. It's a road legal car on road legal tyres. That's pretty impressive, isn't it?
So fast. It is so fast. You see, there's, yeah, for road cars, there's always been this sort of bar to duck under. And if you can get under that bar, you can, you know, the car can be considered to be a really, really quick car. And the bar is 130. Yeah. If you could, I mean, I can remember years back, taking an Aston Martin V12 Vantage down there. Probably not on terribly sticky tyres. But the idea just being to see how close I could get to the original lap record set in the 1960s by Jim Clark and Jackie Stewart. And I think I did a 27 and really scared myself and just thought, that's fast enough. And these guys have gone 12 seconds quicker than that around that circuit. I mean, that is, I mean, you know, one, if you know Goodwood, and I'm sure there'll be any number of people listening to this who've not only been there, but been around it, done track days there and so on. That's a crazy time. That's a crazy, crazy time for a road car on road tyres. Yeah, fair play.
So, I find this so interesting. The thing about setting a lap time in any car really around Goodwood is that the place has not changed. Okay, they stuck a chicane in there in 1952. The chicane is still there, but the circuit layout is the same.
Identical.
And it might be that a curb stone has moved here and there and there's a bit more runoff area or whatever. But the circuit itself is unchanged. And that makes it...
The bit you drive around
almost,
is the same.
Yeah, yeah. Makes it almost unique, doesn't it, among certainly... Well, the circuits anywhere, I suppose. There must be some that are unchanged, but... The vast majority have been tweaked and fiddled with and opened out and widened and, you know, sanitised and whatever.
Of circuits that are in, you know, regular use and of international fame, I'd be surprised if there is another one in the world of that age. I mean, obviously, you could build one last week and say, well, it hasn't changed. But one of that age since 1952, which has gone for whatever that is, it's nearly 70 years. It's nearly 70 years unchanged. I can't believe there's another circuit in the world that's like that.
Mm. So, it's a unique thing. And it just means that we can start looking at how a modern, very high-performance road car compares to a Formula One car from a particular era or from a Can-Am car or whatever else it might be. So it's a unique thing and just quite an intriguing proposition. So... I've been diving into it a little bit, and I've written a story for the intercooler. If you want the full story, it's on the app now. I think it's quite an interesting piece, and it's just sort of made possible by the fact that Goodwood is this freak among racetracks for not having changed for decades. I did speak to Ollie Webb, the driver, and he said the thing is when a car manufacturer of any flavor, any size. sets a lap record and announces a lap record, we all assume that they've been there for 3 days, dialing the car in, fiddling with tyre pressures, waiting for optimal conditions and all that stuff. But actually, they were just there anyway, doing a customer car handover. And they had their mono R, and so they just thought, well, okay, off you go, Ollie, see what she'll do. And that's what they came away with, a 1 minute 15. And Ollie reckons that they could go much faster with, he said the gear ratios weren't quite right. So they, and you know, fiddle with the setup, all that sort of stuff. They could find plenty of lap time. It was interesting. He also said that because the mono R is not a downforce car, and it doesn't have stacks of power. It's still got a naturally aspirated four-cylinder engine. And so actually it's not ideally suited to a circuit where you're flat out going very, very fast for long periods of time. It's actually better suited to circuits with very tight corners, because then it's lightweight construction. It helps it under braking, helps it under acceleration. Really at Goodwood, I think you want lots of downforce and lots of power, don't you?
Yeah, you do. Yeah. No, it absolutely does. And, you know, it's all the more remarkable that it could do such a time, you know, at a circuit to which it clearly is well-suited, but nothing like as well-suited as it might be to something, you know, slower and tighter, definitely.
Yeah. So for the story, I've looked into some other fast road-legal car lap times around Goodwood, and also dug out some lap times from when Formula One cars were racing there. We'll come back to that. And there are some great stories surrounding lap times and Goodwood, potentially apocryphal. We don't know how true they are, but hey, they're great stories, so why not retell them? So the article is up on the app now. Go and have a look. But let's get back to Goodwood itself and just sort of talk about the history of the place. Now, I know that all this stuff is up in your head anyway, Andrew, but I've got it written down in front of me. And the place was, during the Second World War, it was known as RAF Westhampnet, which was a relief airfield for RAF Tangmere nearby. So when Tangmere was at full capacity, planes could come back and land at Westhampnet. It was a sort of emergency use.
Or when Tangmere had the hell bombed out of it and there were holes on the runway. Then they had other places they could go to, and Goodwood was one of them.
And like several other UK circuits, the Goodwood Motor Circuit uses the old perimeter road around the outside of the... And that gives it a very distinctive shape, doesn't it? And it's a shape that's quite similar to Thruxton, quite similar to Castle Combe, quite similar to the early Silverstone layouts.
These are not coincidences.
No, and it means that these circuits have a very particular character, doesn't it? It means they're very, very high speed. They're flowing, fast layouts where you really have to be confident in the car, commit, and it makes them a very particular challenge.
It also, I mean, there's a clue in that word perimeter, isn't it? You know, the circuits ran around the edge of the facility, which also means that in all these places, there's not really anywhere to go if you fall off, because you're already on the perimeter. You're already at the edge. And after the edge, you just get a bank. All those places you mentioned, apart from obviously Silverstone, which had changed so much, but Coombe and Thruxton and Goodwood, it's not just the track, is it? It's the whole mental challenge of thinking, you know, if I get it wrong now, it's not just a question of, you know, driving off the circuit and come back on again. You know, it's probably going to be expensive and it might hurt. And that's you know, that in it's as much as the challenge of just negotiating your way around a place that is as rapid as Goodwood. There's also mentally dealing with that knowledge that it's really, you know, very rarely it has a, you know, a particularly happy ending if you fall off there at high speed too.
Oh, crikey. What I love about those circuits is that nobody has designed those track layouts. Nobody has gone, oh, I think we should have a left-hander here. It's just following what was there. And it's, I don't know, really. It just means that they have a very different character to somewhere like a current-day Snetterton or something, which has been very deliberately laid out. And I just think it's great. It also means that it suits cars with old tyres that inherently want to slide.
No, it's very interesting. But actually, if you look at the, you know, the greatest circuits around the world, you think about, you know, you think about Spa, you think about Le Mans, or many of the circuits we talk about. I mean, those are all circuits that just happened. You know, I guess the Nürburgring is probably the exception, isn't it? The Nürburgring is the one circuit which was actually designed by some certifiable lunatic in the 1920s, because, you know, well, it was done as a sort of compulsory employment program at the time, wasn't it? But I mean, that is, you know, an example of a circuit that was designed and is incredible. But no, the vast majority of them just happened. It's remarkable.
Yeah, it's cool. So it's a 2.4 mile track, first used for racing on the 18th of September 1948. Tell us a little bit about some of the racing that went on there, because I mean, it drew the biggest names in motorsport.
Yeah, I mean, so it never held a world championship Formula One race. It held lots of Formula One races, but no one ever scored any championship points racing there. Didn't stop the whole world turning up there. That was back in the day when people just raced when there was racing to do, because A, they loved it. B, there was start money. C, races had, you know, an individual prestige to them, which made manufacturers want to go and do them. So they all raced there. And it started. It was started by the current Duke of Richmond's grandfather, Freddie March, who was just a complete petrol head and just loved it and just had this mad idea of going racing around, you know, this now rather underused airfield that was, you know, stuck out the back of the estate. And as soon as it started, it just captured something, and they were overwhelmed. They just had, you know, they just had something absolutely amazing. And you know, if you think about the people who raced there in the early days, you know, some of the people like, I don't know, Sterling, Derek Bell, John Surtees, they all did their first ever car races at Goodwood. Some of them had their first wins at Goodwood. And from there on in the history of British motorsport, it is so, from there until it shut in 1966, it was so much part, frankly, it was absolutely as much part of the British motorsport calendar as the British Grand Prix. And some really, really important stuff went on there. You know, they had the 9-hour races there in the early 1950s, which was as close to a Le Mans type event as Britain has ever held, I guess, in terms of its sort of prestige. There were some amazing battles and things, you know, important stuff happened. Like, you know, it may not have held the Formula One Grand Prix, but it was for a while part of the official World Sports Car Championship. And in fact, indeed, in 1959, Aston Martin won the World Sports Car Championship for the first time after 10 years of trying at Goodwood. And the crazy thing about that was they hadn't even intended to enter it because what they wanted to do was win Le Mans. And they tried and they tried and they tried and they just hadn't done it. They'd come second three times in the 50s. And then in 1959, they thought, right, OK, we're going to stop everything else. We're just going to win Le Mans. We're going to focus everything on that. But Sterling wanted to do the Nürburgring 1000 Ks because he'd won it the year before. And he persuaded them to lend him the spare car on the basis that he would pay for it. He would pay the entry fee. Sterling said, I'll do that if I can keep the prize money. And he went and won it. Then there was Le Mans, and Aston Martin won that. And because there were only five rounds in the championship, they suddenly discovered that with one round left, the TT at Goodwood, that they could win the championship. They'd never intended to enter if they just won at Goodwood. And the DBR1, which was their car at the time, was particularly well suited to Goodwood because it didn't have the power of the Ferraris, but that sort of, it handled beautifully on one of those really, really fast flowing. You know, if you're at Le Mans, you just want power, you know, down the straight, bang, which it didn't have. But on flowing high speed circuits like that, the DBR1 was the class of the field. So Sterling duly disappeared and all was looking good until he brought the car. His teammate Roy Salvadori brought the car into the pits, and the whole thing went up in flames. The car literally, you know, the pits went up, the car went up, Salvadori went up. I mean, thankfully, he wasn't too badly hurt. But they thought, well, that's it. The car's gone. It wasn't actually. They actually discovered that the car wasn't that badly damaged and it could have rejoined, but they just thought, oh no, they didn't have any pits, they had nothing. But what there was further down the pit lane, there was a privateer I think it was one of the Whitehead brothers who had his own Aston Martin, his own private Aston Martin in the race. And they wandered down there and said, would you mind terribly retiring your car so we can use your pit so we got somewhere to park? And they then got, I think it was Carroll Shelby, who was in one of their other works cars, who was nowhere, he was like sort of third or fourth, to come in and said, out you get, we're putting Stirling in. And back then you could put drivers in it. And Stirling rejoined the race, nowhere, and being Stirling, went off and won it. And as he won it, he won Aston Martin the World Sports Car Championship too. So it's just one of those great motor racing stories, the likes of which, you know, I just absolutely love. And, you know, and there are plenty of others too. You know, in 19, when was it? 19, it's not nice. Stirling won the TT there. So the Tourist Trophy race was held there in the late 50s and the early 60s. And Stirling won it, not just in the DBR1 in 59, but then it became a GT race in 60 and 61. And he won it in Rob Walker Ferrari 250 short wheelbases. And on one of those races, he was so far ahead. He was in such a different league that he was listening to Raymond Baxter commentating on him winning the race, sitting in the Ferrari on the car radio as he's going round. Just brilliant. It's just absolutely brilliant.
That's
great. Yeah, it's very, very cool. And you know, I could go on relentlessly, but gives you kind of idea of the sort of flavour of the place, I hope.
Okay, so the F1 races that were held there, they, as Andrew said, they weren't world championship races, but they drew the big names, and it was known as the Glover Trophy or the Sunday Mirror Trophy. And the last one was in 1965. I just want to read the results sheet out to you. I won't read every name, but just list. It is a who's who of racing drivers from that era. Jackie Stewart put it on pole, but he had a camshaft fail on the first lap, so he retired very early on. It was then won by Jim Clark, and second was Graham Hill, and third was Jack Brabham, fourth was Bruce McLaren, fifth was Joe Bonnier, sixth was Richard Atwood, and then you keep going down the list and you see Dan Gurney, Jochen Rindt, Joe Siffert, Mike Hailwood. It's, I mean, the big names from racing in that era. And you can just imagine what it must have been like to have gone down to Goodwood to see all those guys racing. I would love to have been there.
It would have been amazing to see those cars and those guys. And yeah, and they would have really, really tried. Like, I remember talking to, with this story that I did when I tried to get close to Jackie's lap record back then, I can remember ringing him up and saying, you know, what was it about those cars? Because, you know, there I was with a 6-litre V12 Aston Martin with modern brakes and modern suspension and big fat tyres. And Jackie was in a normally aspirated 1.5-litre car on bicycle tyres like this and just saying, I just don't understand. And, you know, and he was too modest to say, well, yeah, well, you're Andrew Franklin, I'm Jackie Stewart. That's one fairly large reason I went a bit faster. But what he did say was, you know, you don't underestimate just how hard they tried, not just in the race, but in setting the car up. They would test and they would test and they would test. So the suspension was always optimal. They would bring innumerable gear sets down. And he would say that they would actually gear the car depending on which way down the straight the wind was blowing. So if it was if the wind was behind you, you'd put a slightly higher fifth, or in fact, in his case, probably sixth gear in the car. That was the attention to detail, even back then, whatever it was, 55 years ago, 56 years ago, that they were taking to optimise the performance of their car. And it kind of makes you wonder, doesn't it, just what might happen if one day someone was to put a modern Formula One car around there with that attention to detail. Just set it up. Just do it once. Just do an out, a flyer, and an in. What it would do.
Oh, it's such a shame that we're unlikely to see that happen. But just imagine, there'd be so much PR in that. Why can't Merck just send a car down there, put Lewis in, and just see what happens? It'd be fantastic, wouldn't it?
I have wondered it so often. I've suggested it. So, I mean, because, you know, I have a column that I write for, that I've written for Goodwood every Friday for years and years and years. So I've been in touch with them, and I've often said, why not just do it? And, you know, and they always go, oh, yeah, that's a good idea, but they haven't done it. And I just wonder whether they're not just sort of keeping it up their sleeve just to do. I mean, you'd sell the place out if that's all that happened there that day. Just one lap.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, Yeah, people would just want to know, wouldn't they?
Yeah.
Okay, so when Clark and Moss and co. were racing there in 65... when Clark and Stewart and co. were racing there in 1965... I think you've told me before that they were effectively built to Formula 2 spec. They were a little 1.5 litre cars.
Well, the engines were, yeah. So it's in 1961, because the 2.5 litre cars were, people were dying, frankly, and they just wanted to slow the whole thing down. And back then, Formula 2 was a 1.5 litre formula. So they just said, as from 1961, Formula 1 runs to Formula 2 regs. And from 61 to the end of 65, that's what happened. And then in 66, we know the 3 litre V8s came in and V12s and, the rest is history. But yeah, they were all just normally aspirated 1.5s.
So not particularly powerful. Do you have a BHP figure in your head for one of those?
Yeah, the best of them were doing, more than you'd think. The best of them were doing, so the Climax and the BRMs were probably doing about 210 horsepower out of a 1.5. Spinning it at about 11 and a bit thousand revs. So, proper, but but still proper for a normally aspirated 1.5 litre engine 55 years ago. It's not much by today's standards. It's not much by Golf R standards, is it? Let alone racing car standards. But back then it was pretty impressive.
So it was in 1962 that Stirling had his crash there. At St. Mary's, and it ended his career, really, didn't it? His top flight racing career.
It absolutely ended his career. He only raced professionally once more after that, which was a rather misguided attempt to do touring cars with Martin Brundle in Audi in 1980 and 81, I think. It was a career ender for him, but it was also, and I did once put this to him, and I've talked about that on this podcast before, it was also probably a lifesaver. It almost killed him, but it almost certainly saved him as well, because he reckoned his plan was to keep racing into the mid-70s. I think he was 32 when he had his accident, and he was very mindful of the fact that his old mate and teammate, Fangio, was winning world championships at 47. So he thought, well, I should be able to do that. So he would have been thinking in 62, well, I've got another 15 years, so I'll still be not kicking about in the mid-70s. And, he first started racing in 1948. I don't think the chances, someone would be able to work out the odds of someone racing at that level that often for that long over what would have been a near 30-year career. The chances of surviving that, I think, would have been astronomically small. I did once put it to him that crash actually saved his life, and he didn't deny it.
Yeah, wow, that's interesting. Do you know what the circumstances of that crash were?
I know exactly what I know what the circumstances of that crash were, as much as anybody does, and the truth is that nobody knows. He was in a thing called the Lotus 18/21, and he'd had a problem with it, so he was nowhere in the race. But as always was the case with Stirling, he was always flat out. He wanted to get the fastest lap, so he's coming back through the field. And he came out of Madgwicks, which is turn one, went through Fordwater kink, and was overtaking Graham Hill. He was overtaking Graham Hill on the outside, and something happened. Whether Graham Hill didn't see him and moved over, whether there was a mechanical failure in the grass, nobody knows. All that is known is that Stirling found himself on the grass, travelling at, 120, 130 miles an hour. If you just go down the grass and you don't turn into the corner, you just go head on into the bank, which is what happened. I think the only thing that you can rule out is driver error on Stirling's part. I don't think that is in any way conceivable. I don't think anyone ever has suggested that Stirling made a mistake. I don't see actually how on that part of the track you really could make a mistake. So something happened. It was a mechanical failure. Maybe it was Graham Hill didn't see him coming past. Who knows? But as we know, he did go into the bank at horrendous speed. The car penknifed around him, big brain injury, lots of broken bones. Game over, career-wise.
Mm. He used to show people the steering wheel, didn't he? With a huge fold in it. yeah, caused in fact, by in fact, his
he,
head
he,
hitting it.
I don't know where it was his head. I think it was, oh, maybe it was. There was another one. He had in his downstairs loo in Shepherd Street, where he lived. He had two steering wheels. He had that steering wheel and another one from an accident he had at Spa in 1960, which is also another big kink in it. And that kink was made by his leg as he came out the car. It just, you know, banged the steering wheel. Yeah, well, funnily enough, yes, that broke a few bones too. But he was always very sort of, you know, funny about these things. He was very happy to show people these things. He wasn't in the least bit squeamish about it.
Okay, well, we should move it on a little bit. And it was in 66 that the racing stopped at Goodwood. Now, I've got an answer here, but I'm just curious to know what your understanding of why they had to stop racing there was.
It was just getting crazy. It was just getting, the cars were getting too fast. And you don't forget, we're now talking about 3 litre cars. 3 litre, you know, 400 horsepower cars. So almost double the power that the cars had the year before. And I think that the Duke felt that the circuit had its best days, and to keep it going would be to take unnecessary risks with people's lives. I mean, you know, there had already been some big accidents. Their lives had already been lost there. And I think he just felt that it was just too much. I think sadly, but probably rightly, shut the shop.
So yeah, 66, no more racing there. But it was used for testing.
Yeah.
By some quick stuff as well.
Properly quick stuff, yeah.
Yeah, we, and particularly Can-Am cars. And I mean, there are plenty of rumours, aren't there, about the lap times achieved by those Can-Am cars during that era. Some rather fast ones.
Yeah, so, and we must, while we're talking about this, we must pause a moment to remember Bruce McLaren, who died in a Can-Am car in 1970, an M8D, when a bit of bodywork came off. And he was so unlucky. He was going down the main back straight. And there was just one marshal's post in the middle of the straight. And he just went straight into it. You know, a bit earlier, a bit later, he wouldn't have even damaged the car. It was just horrendous bad luck. But yes, moving on. You know, him and Denny Hulme, when they were testing those massive Chevy-powered V8 McLaren Can-Am cars, you know, they were certainly regularly going under 1 minute tens. You hear stories of 103s, 104s, 105s, and, you know, frankly, I believe them. I think they did do a media day where they put some journalists in the passenger seats of these things, and journalists were taken round by Denny Hulme at, you know, 170 miles an hour in a whatever. And even then, you know, they were doing 10-somethings. And, you know, this is half a century ago. And, you know, the cars would have had, I mean, it depends what you mean by downforce. I mean, back then they would have been, oh my God, this thing's got so much downforce. By modern standard, it would be, well, no, it really hasn't. I mean, it might not have much lift, but in terms of positive downforce, there wouldn't have been huge amounts. But they were so fast, they were so grunty, and they had these massive tyres on them. And yeah, they were very, very rapid machines.
So there was some testing going on there, but that did, again, that came to an end in the 80s, I think you said.
I'm not sure. Sooner or later, the noise thing got in the way, and it all had to stop. And then it was just used for, you know, for track days, and it became a very sorry, dilapidated version of its once glorious former self. You know, I can remember going down there for some, well, say, you know, the first ever time I ever drove on a track would have been in about 84 or 85. And you just go there and you go through the tunnel into the paddock, and there was nothing there. I mean, the old buildings were still sort of dotted around the place, but it was just, okay, I wouldn't say it was quite derelict, but it was certainly very dilapidated, very shabby. The track was still wonderful, and you just get on it, pay a few quid and blunder around. And even then, I can remember thinking, A, this is very sad, but B, just thinking of that sense of occasion. I'm still driving around this track that Stewart and Hill and Clark and Sterling, you know, my heroes. You know, this is where these guys were at their best. These are the guys where they really showed what they were made of. And there was me in a falling off in a 205 GTI or whatever, on exactly the same bit of turf, and it seems remarkable even to think about it now, let alone to, you know, to actually go and do it then.
Oh, that's interesting. And so it was in 1998 that racing returned to Goodwood.
Yeah.
And I don't know when it was really updated, that place, and made beautiful again. Because if you go there now, it's really beautifully presented.
Yeah, I mean, it was done for that original meeting in 1998. So the whole idea... So when the current Duke, the then Earl of March, Lord March... when he moved into the Goodwood estate, he just decided that his mission was to get the motor circuit reopened. And he knew it would take a bit of time. And what he also wanted was to really build up a head of steam before that happened. And he knew the planning and the changes that would need to be made would take not months, but years. But he wanted to get motorsport back to Goodwood. So he had an idea for a little garden party, which was called the Festival of Speed. And we know how that turned out. That started in 93, I think. And he did that for 5 years, by which stage it was, you know, one of the biggest, frankly, biggest sporting events of any kind on the calendar, which did all sorts of things. It provided the money to transform the race circuit. It gave him time to get the permissions that he needed. It gave him the credibility to get the backing that that he required. And it just got the whole idea of Goodwood front and centre in the minds of the car-loving public in a way that it hadn't been since the mid-1960s. So, you know, obviously work has gone on since. But, I mean, I can remember, because I was lucky enough to race in that first revival, going down there and going in there and just being completely and utterly blown away. I mean, one of the most remarkable things I have ever seen in my career was going into Goodwood that day and seeing what they had done to it. I was the editor of Motorsport, which is why I'd been able to blag myself a ride in something. He set a template that year, which, you know, has worked so well ever since. And that... it was such a gutsy thing to do. It was so brave, in many ways more brave than originally opening the circuit in 1948. And to do it in such a wholehearted, such an utterly committed way. I mean, this was no, you know, toe dip exercise, just seeing if the concept worked, and if it did, then maybe we'll do it properly in a couple of years' time. This was right, we're doing this. Completely committed, 100% full on. We're just going to do the best historic motor racing event. So much better, so much more creative, imaginative, beautiful, atmospheric, enthusiastic, varied than anything else that had ever been anywhere in the world. And we're just going to kind of hope that people buy into it. We know from the fact that the revival, that the circuit in its second generation has now been going for really quite a lot longer than it did in its first. We know that the proof of, you know, the proof of that was made very quickly.
Yeah, that's a very good point, actually. Whenever you go there, there's a sense that it is now how Moss and Clark and Stewart and Hill will have known it. And it just feels like a sort of time warp throwback thing.
It does.
I love being there. I've driven sort of pathetically few laps of that place. And it seems like an intimidating track to me, the kind of place where you need plenty of confidence. I always go around those first couple of corners, never really knowing where I'm supposed to be. And at times it's blind and you can't see where the track goes. So it's a proper challenge. But I just want you to talk me through a flying lap of Goodwood. And I don't know what you're in, but it's something a bit old with lots of power, no downforce and not a great deal of grip. And you've come out of the chicane and you're flying across the start-finish line down towards the first corner. Where are you putting the car?
So obviously you come out of the chicane on the right-hand side of the track and you want to be over on the left for Madgwick. So let's say let's go for something quite tricky. A Ferrari 750 Monza that I was lucky enough to race there a few times. So You come out the chicane in third, fourth, fifth, and then you're back into fourth because it's quite a short box. For the right-hander into Madgwick, and the car, the track goes over a rise, and there are very definitely two apexes, but you don't have to hit the first one. And in fact, I try quite hard not to, because I tend to think it spits you out a bit early on. I'm a bit scared and I don't want to be too close to the edge of the track on the exit. So the thing to do is nail the second apex, and then if you can do that, and then you can power on and you can drift the car out to the left-hand side of the track, and that's actually, as long as you understand, as long as you get the positioning, actually, that's really quite straightforward. Then you've got the Ford Water kink, which is just one of those things where whether it is flat or not just depends on, you know, the car you're in, the mood you're in. And in the Ferrari, it was probably not quite flat. It wouldn't have been a brake, but it would have been a lift, maybe even just a confidence lift if you got it absolutely lined up. But the problem is the track falls away a bit at the exit, and the left-hand side, it just comes rushing, the edge of the track just comes rushing up at you, and you're going as fast as the car will go pretty much then. And that's just properly scary. And so I'm probably a bit too timid through there. But anyway, you're then back on the gas going down to the right-hander, which some people call No Name because it doesn't officially have a name, but is known as the right-hander going to St Mary's, which is where Stirling had his accident on the left. And most people position themselves on the right-hand side of the track because then you get a sort of straight braking area into it. I think if you've got a really well set up car, you can keep to the left a bit, but the braking area is then curved. And if you're in an old shed, braking and turning can sometimes be a bit tricky. And then in the Ferrari, you're fifth, back down into fourth, into the right-hander, very, very quick corner of the right-hander going, much quicker. It's the corner, I think, where you can probably save the most time because it's much quicker than most people think. The problem with it, it's got a much slower left coming up immediately afterwards, so you can't do anything with that extra speed. You have to lose it almost immediately. But again, it pays to be brave because, again, the left-hand side of the track just seems a bit scarily close. And then you've got a break, and then you're fourth through the right and then into third. So I'm pulling back because it's got a dogleg box. And some people say actually you should get a wheel up on a curb there because that kind of pulls the car into the apex and you get a lot more grip. Because I'm always in somebody else's car, I don't do that. So I get as close to the curb as I can, and then you power on hard and drift it out, and the track then goes down and slightly up. And so you can kind of use the rise to get the car over to the right-hand side, and then a quick squirt up to fourth and then back to third for Lavant, which is, you know, it's the most important corner on the track. It's the easiest corner on the track, but it's the most important because it leads onto the big straight. Two apexes. And I think the mistake a lot of people make, and I say this absolutely as one of them, is because it's actually quite a safe corner because it's not very fast and there's a bit of space to go. That's the one where you really want to do that and have fun and go sideways and everything else. But all the time you're doing that, you're losing speed down the straight. So try to resist, you know, your inner idiot, and just try to keep it, just think about traction. It's all about getting back on the power as soon as you can. I mean, the Ferrari was very good at that because although it had a very torquey engine, it had a transaxle, it had a gearbox between the rear wheels, so you could get back on the power quite early. And then just third, fourth, fifth down the straight. There's a kink halfway down the straight, which in the wet is actually a proper corner. In the dry, it's easy flat. And then it's just a question of bravery under brakes. In the Ferrari, you've got drums, which they're actually pretty good for drum brakes, but they need a bit of managing. So you can't just mash them. Because what the problem with those drums is once they go, they stay gone. They don't sort of come back to you. So you have to manage them through the course of the race. It's a bit different in qualifying. You can lean on them a bit harder. There's a bit of curbing on the left-hand side, which is usually about when you'd start in a car like that, you'd think about starting to brake. And then fifth, either fourth, maybe third, probably no, fourth for Woodcote, which is the penultimate corner, so it's the one before the chicane. Miss the first apex completely. If you hit the first apex, you're going to go spinning off on the left-hand side. So almost drive around the outside of the track, nail the second exit, slide out to the exit, and then a naggy, tiny little straight up to the chicane, fourth, third, chicane, off, another lap. There you go.
And you're on pole. Congratulations.
If only. I was third in that car in the last race I did in that, so yes.
Good stuff. Wow, that was impressive. I didn't tell you I was going to ask you to do that. That was all off the top of your head. That's impressive.
Yes, if you get to do something like that at a place like that, in a car like that, it does tend to stay with you.
Yeah, I'm sure.
It's the sort of thing that is easily forgotten.
So at the start of this episode, I posited that maybe Goodwood is the UK's best circuit. But actually, I won't ask you that. I'll just ask you if it's your favourite circuit in the UK.
Yeah, it is. It is because, you know, there are bits of other circuits I absolutely adore. The Beckett's complex at Silverstone is just mega. Cranor curves at Donington, out of this world. There are all sorts of bits of other circuits that I love. But if you could say to me one more lap and that's it, you're never going to drive around a track again, where do you want it to be? I'd want it to be in something really powerful at Goodwood. No question at all. Because I think it is just such a, it's such a beautifully evocative place, and the beauty of it does mean a lot to me. I mean, I can remember doing they have these sort of day night races which end in the dusk, and if you're lucky enough to do one of those and you're out the back of the circuit and the sun is coming down and you're in some beautiful old racing car, it's a genuine romance about it. There is something which completely transcends the fact you happen to be racing a car. There's an entire other dimension about being there at that time in that thing. And you just don't get that anywhere else. So, Goodwood and something fast and scary, please.
That's great. Thank you. That was cool. Okay, good. Well, we'll leave that one there. That's Goodwood. Please go and check out the app. That's all I want you to do. Just go and search the Intercooler app on the app stores. You'll find it. Subscribe. You can do so for free for a month and cancel if you don't like it. But we think you'll stay with us. There's some good stuff on there. We'll be back to talk to you again on this podcast next week.
Look forward to it. Thanks all.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
A lot can happen in the next 3 years. Like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans are available for these changing times. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer budget-friendly, flexible coverage for people who are in between jobs or missed open enrollment. The plans last nearly 3 years in some states, with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. So for whatever tomorrow brings, UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans may be for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.